Good morning, everybody. I'm trying not to start, as my natural inclination is to start on Irish time, which means we would start about 10:30. But I'm trying to be disciplined and respect those of you who travelled such a long way to be here and have done such important work in this field. I'm Paul Bew. I'm the chairman of the Anglo-Israel Association. This is our 9th, I think, Ambassadors Roundtable Conference. And I think I've been at 8 at least, and they have all been characterized by an excellent dialogue between people with strong scientific capacity and interest in both Israel and the United Kingdom. And I have no doubt, looking at the names and looking who we've been lucky enough to get here today, that today will be similarly an interesting and frank dialogue and value to everyone who is here. So first of all, I want to thank those who have come, especially those who travel from Israel. I particularly want, you would know that to produce something like this, it does require work behind the scenes, and it does require guidance as to who the right speakers are, what the right topics are, how things should be divided up. And I particularly want to thank Kobe Friedman, who is there on my left, for the amazing work that he has done in helping the AIA. Purely structurally, from then on, there is also another level of organization. And I have to say, I have an executive committee, which is wonderful. And Ruth Saunders, our executive director, has flawlessly put together these events over the years in a way which I regard as quite magical. And I want to say thank you to Ruth as well as to Kobe. But I do want to say really thank you to everybody. We are tremendously fortunate that the ambassador from Israel, Mark Regev, is here, and our deputy ambassador in the UK Embassy in Tel Aviv, Tony Kay, is here on my left. It's always been very helpful to us to have the support from the ambassadors, both in London and in Israel. So and I'm grateful to both of them for maintaining that tradition, which has helped us keep functioning and making this day a success. So with those words, I simply want to end my welcome. It's the warmest welcome I can manage, a warm Irish welcome for you, and it's not at 10:30. We're more or less on time. So welcome to everybody, and I hope you enjoy the conference today. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. And we will move on to...
pulling together such a fantastic event. The UK-Israel bilateral relationship is going from strength to strength. It keeps Ambassador Regev and his team here in London extremely busy, and it keeps our team in Tel Aviv extremely busy as well. And it's across the whole landscape of issues, whether it's security, defence, counter-terrorism, trade, investment, science, innovation, and importantly, the technological relationship between the UK and Israel. Is really moving ahead with great speed and great energy. And that is personified by the UK-Israel Tech Hub, which has been up and running now for 6 years. It's an innovation in itself, and it really is going from strength to strength. Ben-Gurion has a revolving door for UK companies, big UK institutions, who are coming to Israel to develop the relationship that they have with the startup nation. Over 100 deals have been signed over the years. And you know, just if you reel off the numbers of companies that are involved in Israel, companies like BT, Aviva, RBS, Barclays, the NHS, Marks and Spencer's, Topshop, AstraZeneca, GSK. These are just some of the companies that have been through Israel in the last couple of months and developing really important strategic relationships where the Israeli innovation is making them and the UK more efficient, more effective, and helping to grow the UK and indeed the Israeli economy. So this event is perfectly timed. As we move forward, the UK-Israel Tech Hub is focusing on such issues as cyber, mobility, healthcare, and retail. And it's been so successful that the UK government is rolling out 5 new tech hubs based on the UK-Israel model in countries like Brazil, South Africa, and elsewhere. So it's really great that that UK-Israel innovation is going to help grow innovation in those new countries around the world. So, Lord Bew, thank you so much for the invitation. It's always a pleasure to visit London from Tel Aviv, where I believe today it's 22 degrees. Although it is raining in good old British fashion in Israel right now. And with that, I'll hand over to Ambassador Regev. Thank you.
Thank you, Tony. I'd like to start off also by thanking Lord Bew. I'd like to thank the executive committee of the Anglo-Israel Association, but a special thanks to Ruth Saunders, yes, who we know how important she is in making all these things happen. Thank you, Ruth. Israel Central Bureau of Statistics have just crunched all the numbers for 2017, and it appears that last year Israeli-UK bilateral trade reached £6.9 billion, which is an all-time high, £6.9 billion. Which, when you compare to the numbers of last year, that's a 25% increase. Mm. Now, that's amazing. A 25% increase in bilateral trade in a 12-month period, that's because of the good work that Tony and his team are doing at the embassy. And it's also because it's there's something going here, something strong, something dynamic, something very powerful. In fact, if you look at the trade numbers, they keep going like this. And I think we're all here today because we know that that momentum will continue and that we expect the trade between the two countries to continue to grow in the future. What are the reasons for the strength and the dynamism in the Israel-UK partnership? I think we can point to 3 fundamental factors. The first is there's no doubt that both our countries share excellence in world-class scientific research. We both have very, very high quality, internationally recognized academic institutions. We have scholars, we have academics, we have scientists who are doing the research. And as governments, we are encouraging those academic partnerships. My embassy, just in November last year, we organized a delegation of vice chancellors of a dozen leading British universities. We brought them to Israel. They met the different Israeli universities. I think they were everywhere. They were at the Technion, they were in University of Tel Aviv, University in Jerusalem, in Haifa, in Beersheba. The idea is to expand the very tangible partnerships, research cooperation between Israeli academic institutions and British institutions. I can tell you that the foreign ministry, who I work for in Jerusalem, in its wisdom, has given us a budget to do the same thing again this year. So we're looking for another delegation forward. We're looking forward to another delegation of vice chancellors, leadership from British academic institutions coming to Israel again in 2018, and this is something we want to push. The other issue, another reason I think for the dynamism in the relationship, above and beyond the academic excellence that our country shares, is no doubt the entrepreneurial spirit. That in Israel and in the UK, there's an understanding that we are parts of the global economy, we are trading countries, we are countries that have a global outlook. We are countries that encourage a pro-business climate, and of course, rule of law and all those issues, very, very important. We, as you know, in Israel established recently the office called the Israel Innovation Authority, which replaced the office of the chief scientist, and together we are working to encourage innovation. And as Tony said very truthfully, the UK-Israel Tech Hub is an example of the British government supporting in a very hands-on way this sort of scientific cooperation in high tech. And the third and final reason, I think, for the strength of the relationship is, of course, innovation. And here we can look at some interesting numbers where the UK and Israel are out there world leaders in innovation. Last year, in the innovation index put out by Bloomberg, both Israel and Britain were in the 20 leading innovation countries on the planet. Israel in number 10, slightly leading the UK, which was put by Bloomberg at number 17, but still in the top 20. However, in the Global Talent Competitive Index, Britain beat Israel on knowledge skills. They were number 3 in the world, and Israel was number 4 in the world. And so it's clear we're both countries that understand the future belongs to those who innovate, the future belongs to the next generation's conceptual products, and that's one of the reasons, I think, for the strength in the partnership. You should know that Israel's top destination in Europe for foreign direct investment is the United Kingdom. And Britain is Israel's fourth largest European source of foreign direct investment. And I think that's also a sign of the strength in the relationship. Now, we're here today, you're here today to talk about artificial intelligence. And there's no doubt that this is a huge growth area. I believe both globally, but also in the bilateral partnership between our two countries. The strength of artificial intelligence in Israel, I think, was shown very clearly to all by the Mobileye Intel deal last year, where an Israeli startup that deals with autonomous driving technology, not really a startup anymore now, a global company, was bought by Intel for $15.3 billion. That's amazing. But also, you should know that we've identified 437, that's the Israel Innovation Authority, has identified 437 other startups pioneering in artificial intelligence. The estimation is that the potential in artificial intelligence is huge, and that by 2025 we're talking about a $50 billion framework, and that if Israel and Britain working together in artificial intelligence, we can get a huge chunk of that. And that's something I think both economies are aspiring to do. So I'm sure you will discuss all that and much, much more today in your discussions. I know that this is a crucial part of the bilateral partnership, and I wish you all a successful and productive day.
Thank you. Thank you very, very much, Ambassador Rego. Thank you very much, Tony. I think we can move on. I think we're due to start first session 10:15, and we are, well, just after 10:15. So can we move in and hand over to the chair of that session? We are ready to go. But again, my deep thanks to Ambassador Regev and Deputy Ambassador Kay for what they've said, which has got us off to an excellent start. Thank you very much to both of you.
Thank you.
So, it's Mark. And it's Mark, who's the chair of the Mark Tisner. Sorry, that, I didn't know. Thank you. So, can you...
It's better, thank you.
My apologies.
That's okay. So it's my great pleasure to chair the first session. The first session is on deep learning, and we're going to have three relatively short talks related to deep learning. So each talk is about 20 minutes long. And after that, we are going to have a joint Q&A for all of these three talks. I think it's fine to ask very brief questions if a clarification is needed, but otherwise, please take notes and have those longer, more interesting questions at the end. So we're going to have three speakers. So we're going to start with Uzi Haddad, who is going to talk more about the engineering perspective on deep learning, some engineering challenges. Then there will be Fabio Kuzulin, who is going to talk more about the theory of mind related to deep learning. And then Margarita Ozaci is going to conclude this session with highlighting some challenges posed by deep learning. And so without wasting more time, I would hand over to Uzi, and I'm looking forward to your talk.
Thank you. Good morning. First, it is a pleasure to be here. Thank you for the invitation. The title of my talk is about the big question that we have in deep learning and the correlation to the challenges that we encounter
in engineering, in making, in building a real product in production, which are based on deep learning. So I will start with a short history because it will be relevant to the terms that I would like to say today. So let's go back in the history to the 60s. In the 60s, many scientists thought that the AI will revolution the world. Okay, there was several impressive achievement during that time. And it gained momentum, there was a big hype. And this was what the what many major scientists thought during the 60s. And the reason, well, because the following, I'll give you two examples, two nice examples. Can you press on? This is the first autonomous robot.
In a simple villa on the outskirts of Bristol lives Dr. Gray Water, a neurologist, who makes robots as a hobby. They are small, and he doesn't dress them up to look like men. He calls them tortoises. And so cunningly have their insides been designed that they respond to the stimuli of light and touch in a completely lifelike manner.
So this was the first autonomous robot in 1948-49. And when he goes out of battery, he goes back to the charger and charges himself by himself. Same like the iRobot today. Another example is Eliza, which is the first chatbot that was developed in the 60s. And this chatbot tried to simulate a psychotherapist. And as you can see, the discussion to simulate a psychotherapist is in a sense, is easier than simulating a current teenager, because the discussion is very simple. You always ask questions about the answer of the patient. Okay, it's very, very simple. So this is another example, very nice example, that show us that in the 60s, there was a big hope to that the AI will revolution the world. And now I would like to move further to the future and just say one word about the chatbot and then move on to the big question of deep learning. So there was a research recently that was done here in England, and it was about comparing the Eliza, the first chatbot, against the current chatbot. And the results look pretty amazing, that today the chatbot of today are about 2.5 times better than the chatbot that was developed in the 60s. So we have a huge improvement, and we all know and familiar with the improvement in image recognition, in speech, in NLP, and more. But still, we have huge and fundamental problem in deep learning, and this is what I would like to touch and discuss until the end of this lecture. So here are a few of the fundamental questions that I think most of us will agree upon. The first one is why does deep learning work? So we can understand the idea behind deep learning. We can understand that in the end we build a model and we have a mechanism, a tool that knows how to automate the building process. So instead of searching for an algorithm, we just design an architecture and we give the system to learn by using the gradient descent. But in the end, we don't really understand what is the representation that it captures. We don't really understand why we choose this specific number of layers. We don't understand why we choose those specific hyperparameters. There are many, many deep questions what we don't really understand. We have some initiative about it, okay? So what I would try to do now is I would try to say that all those questions are correlated to a difficult challenge, a difficult problem that we encounter in engineering, okay? I'd like to show that there is a direct correlation, and it makes us, the engineering, the people that try to develop a product, the entrepreneurs, makes our life very, very complicated and sometimes impossible. So let's start from the beginning. In deep learning, as you all know, we have a huge number of hyperparameters. Sometimes it's million, sometimes more than million, hundreds of millions. And if you have huge number of hyperparameters, it's obvious that you need a huge amount of data, because otherwise you might encounter the case of the pinhole a principle. It means that the model will not learn something, it just will remember your data, okay, because you have too many parameters to play with. So we need a huge amount of data, and this is a very complex task by itself. It's starting by collecting data, all the ecosystem of the big data, validation, scaling, resource management, and et cetera. It is a very complicated task. We all familiar with this complexity in the regular world of big data. Now it's upon a distributed GPU, and this is like hell. It's very, very complicated. It's not easy. There's no good tool. It's not working out of the box. There's a lot of configuration, setting, and understanding. So our life become much, much more difficult. The second thing is about the software development process. In a regular software, we have a well-defined process about the cycle of development, the cycle of testing, the definition of bug, definition of debugging. But in the deep learning, we don't have it right now. For example, autonomous car. Let's say in about 10 years from now, we have an autonomous car, and we find out that our car doesn't recognize a sign in our street. What we will do? We'll go to the garage, and then what they will do? They will probably will connect it to some computer, and they say, okay, everything looks good. So what we'll do next? We are going to bring a picture of the sign. If you bring your own picture, we tell you, oh, it's not good because this is a different camera. Please bring us a picture from the camera of the car. And then what's next? Who is going to do the debugging? The garage? I believe not. So if you send it to the headquarters, and let's say that in the end they will find the reason for the problem, and they would like to fix it. What do you think? The manager will allow them to fix this specific bug? I don't think so, because there are so much complexity in fixing one bug. There's so much influence of one change in the model, one change in the weight of our deep learning network on the whole system. So the debugging has become very complex, very complex. And also definition, what is a bug? What is how do we build a test plan? In a regular world, we have a definition from the product manager. We have requirements, and we try to build a test plan according to requirement. We have a bounded world, in a way. In deep learning, going again to the autonomous car, we have a case that we are bounded. The distribution space that we're working with is not well defined. There's an infinite option of image. So the definition of test plan is, again, very, very complicated. The next thing is also about the software engineering. Still here, we have other problem, like all the process of logging, application monitoring, stuff that we already have good practice and methodology. How we do it in deep learning? Can we log what the network capture, what the network understand? Can we manage advanced application monitoring about what's going on during the building a model? It's not well defined. And the last thing is about data dependencies. In deep learning, also in machine learning, we have many parts of which are data dependencies. Data dependencies is much more complicated than coding dependency, code dependency. In code dependency, we have tools to resolve it, like static analysis and et cetera. In in data dependencies, we don't have any tool. We need to be very careful because one change in the output of one job can, in fact, dramatically the behavior of the next job. So it's very, very delicate. Okay, going on with the challenges is about the malware. I believe that most of you are aware of the option to attack a deep learning system. There are white attacks and black box attacks. This is one example that showed that in the top row you can see image and you can see the classification by a deep learning model. In the bottom row you can see the same image but with some slight noise, but how the deep learning model recognize them, and you can see that all of them are misclassify them. And again, we don't have a good methodology how to manage attacks on deep learning system. There are very nice work that was done recently. One of them is speaking about, instead of building a model just by learning the real image, let's take the images, the real images, let's add noise to the images, and let's build a model on top of those images. It's a good idea, it's a very nice idea, but there is a con with this idea, because when you add noise to your picture, your model, the accuracy of your model will probably be decreased. So you will probably have much more false and positive result. Next, can you please? This is a nice example about unknown case by the CEO of Microsoft.
And our, for example, in this case, the team is estimating to have a great quarter, they're going to close the deal, but the system is saying, hey, you might have a problem. So that's coming because of the Alpine Metrics analytics tool. And that analytics tool is built on Cortana Analytics, which is a core part of Azure. Now I have that data, but we've also gone one step. Further, in fact, it also tells the various teams in my organization and their close rates and what it predicts will happen. So I can go ahead and, in fact, because of Cortana, I can even integrate it with my voice command. So I can just go ahead and ask for it. Show me my most at-risk opportunities. No, that's not what I want. Let's try it again. Show me my most at-risk opportunities. Oh, come on.
Okay.
Show me my most at-risk opportunities. Now, this is not going to work. Sorry about that. But if I go back in here.
Okay. So this is one nice example about unknowns that we have in deep learning. And one of the reasons for the unknown is, I give another example, then I will explain. Another case is, let's take, for example, case of MRI system. So we build an MRI system, we build a model based on our training set. And everything worked perfect, okay, amazing. And now we have a case that the data that we have in this case is out of the distribution of the data that we learned upon. It means that this is the patient that is now under the MRI, his condition is totally different. He has a different structure of his brain. I don't know, something like that. Then what we will expect from from our model to do? We have a few options. One option, I think it's the best option, that the model will say, okay, guys, I'm not familiar with this type of data. This is what I can say for that. But usually what will happen, the model will try to give some prediction. Although the model never saw anything like that, okay? So again, this is something very, very challenging from engineering perspective. How do we resolve, how do we mitigate this kind of risk? Another thing is about model uncertainty. We can be, when we build a model, usually we build several models with different number of layer, different number of neuron, different hyperparameter, and we get in the end several models that works in with the same results. Which one to choose? Why we choose this instead of that? There is some representation behind it that the model learned, but we don't have the way to understand the representation. So, but in the end, we choose something because it's more convenient, because there is a little, it's a little bit better than the rest. But in a sense, we have real uncertainty in the model that we build, which we must take into account, and especially if we're speaking about engineering and a real product. So move on. I have 3 minutes. Move on to reproducibility. Reproducibility is related to Aristo. We say that if we experiment in science must be reproducible. One of the problems that we have in deep learning that sometimes we cannot reproducible result. You can see many examples of research and project in GitHub that you try to play it at your home, and it doesn't work the same way as was described. There are many reasons for that. One of them is related to the randomness that we have in the model. The second is related to the data set. The third is about the hardware and the software that we use. So this is, and again, another complexity. So to sum up, if you take all the complexity, we end up with a very huge system with a lot of components and dependents, where the machine learning and deep learning is a small part, very important part, but very small part. You can see it in the middle, the ML code. And this is a big challenge to make a working machine learning, deep learning system, to make it work, and especially in critical system like in healthcare, or something which requires a high level of security. Last but not least is about the cost. So we spoke about challenges that related to the theory and to the fundamental question of deep learning, but a few words about cost I must add. Give an example for my company. It's called ControlUp. We are collecting metrics regarding to the CPU, the RAM, everything that happening on your computers. And we are collecting something like 1 giga data per hour. Okay, it's something, if you speak about 1,000 customers, it's about 24 terabyte a day, 9 petabyte a year. It's a huge amount of data. It costs a lot of money to process it, to run model on top of it. So the cost of using deep learning is not cheap, especially if you're trying to be very, very accurate. On top of it, I give another example about the costs. This is the AlphaGo. You're all familiar with the AlphaGo. You can see that in the AlphaGo, the number of people that work on AlphaGo and the number of CPU and GPU, this is not something cheap. This is only Google can provide something like that only for a game, not for something for production, something that makes money. So the cost is also an issue. And again, it's the cost is related to all the fundamental question, all the challenges that I showed you before. So the last thing that I would like to say is the following. Deep learning require many people with many skill that will be able to sit together and build a real working production system. If you go back to the history, the two examples that I gave you were built by one people, okay? The first one, the iRobot, was developed by physics, and the second one is by someone from, which is psychotropic. One guy developed the whole system. Now, the system are very, very complicated, require many people with different skills. And One of the main reasons for the complexity is because we don't really have good understanding. We don't have a well-defined API of what's going on in the low level of the neural network. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much. I'm then immediately handing over to Fabio. Can you get that?
All right, everybody. So I'm Fabio Cuzzolina, a professor of AI at Oxford Brookes. And I'm going to tell you a little bit about how you use deep learning to do something more than pattern recognition, because I think we need to go beyond pattern recognition, really. Been places, so I'm not going to bore you with that, like UCLA, WashU, France, and I'm in Oxford. In my group, we focus a lot on action detection recognition, so we do a lot of work with videos, and that's where intuition we comes from, really, from what follows. And also statistical learning theory, so how to do model adaptation, how to make sure that machine learning models are robust enough to deal with test data that have nothing to do with the data they've been trained on. And we apply that to HRI, moral robotics, and more recently we're shifting to autonomous vehicles because that's pretty much what everybody's doing. And that's where the difficult problems come in. By the way, if you want to stream this, there's a larger version that I gave as a professorial lecture a couple of weeks ago. So you do hear the links for you on Facebook. So we all know the machines are coming, right? Or are they? I mean, it's a bit of a question mark, and that's why I put the question mark over there, because I'm a bit of a skeptic, although I'm a working artificial intelligence. You know, we do have no checkout shops. If you go to Seattle, you can go to Amazon Go and take what you want, leave without checking out. If you wanna press the video, we can show like a short video of how this works. Seems to resist this idea. Okay, you can stop it. You could spend more time here, but you know how this works. This is all based on visual AI, basically. And then you have Tesla and other people. I mean, I'm not related in any way to Tesla or Amazon Go, by the way. And also because I'm not saying nice things about them, necessarily nice things about them. You know, you can drive on a highway 70 miles per hour. Wow, that's very impressive. Or is it? Well, you know, they did have their problems and serious ones. This is a famous case, and you know, a car crashed and a person died. And what was the problem? And they had repeated incidents. Even recently, they had a funny tweet about, you know, their system not being designed to avoid obstacles in the middle of the road and stuff like that. What happened in that particular event, a trailer turned left in front of the Tesla. Tesla didn't see it, didn't stop, and crashed through it, basically. So we need to be cautious about artificial intelligence, especially in mission-critical applications such as autonomous driving. This is my view, at least. What really went wrong, you know, didn't see a truck. That's, you know, object detection, which is one of the simplest possible things you need to do when you do autonomous driving. But the issue is really a fundamental one with the way machine learning works, and this was hinted at in the previous talk. You know, the amount of data we train algorithms is very limited. You can wonder, you know, limited. Tesla has collected data from 1.3 billion miles of driving. You know, if you compare this to what just one autonomous car acquires in a day, that's 4 terabytes of data per day. Is that a lot? What about humans? How much data are we trained on? And the point of this lecture is that we don't just learn from examples, so we don't just learn to recognize patterns, but we understand, we can drive because we understand agents, We don't simply discover patterns. We understand how they work and how they reason. And the end goal, obviously, is to make predictions about the future. So, you know, there's an old science fiction novel from the 50s, and we're like, these aliens with like huge brains can make predictions 2 billion years in the future. It's the Lensman series. We don't want to be that ambitious, but still, we need to move from recognition, even online real-time recognition, to prediction of future events. Again, this is inspired from our current work on event and action detection recognition, obviously. But, you know, it is related to all the critical applications that people are talking about nowadays as, you know, upcoming or like in the next 5 years, next 10 years. And a lot of the time you have to feel that, you know, they don't quite know what they're talking about. I mean, because if they did, they would realize how difficult that is. But again, this is my view. You know, you're a smart car. You have children next to you. Are they going to walk, keep walking on the sidewalk? They're going to cross right in front of me. So this, you need to predict intention, future behavior, and events. This is what you need to do. For instance, if you do autonomous driving, but if you're like a robotic surgeon that is designed to assist a main surgeon in laparoscopy, you need to understand what the surgeon is doing. You need to predict what the future behavior of the surgeon is going to be in order to react to that. Deep learning, you know, it's been very successful. This is what we're talking about today in this session, at least. Seems to be able to encode high level abstractions from the data. You know, as you move up towards the final layers of the network, you encode more and more abstract representations of the external world. So from edges to combinations of edges to finally faces. Which is great. I mean, the problem is that, as my colleague said, the theory is not very well understood. Although there's a few papers coming out, but not a lot yet, and there are lots of empirical investigations that try and understand what the different neurons produce in response to different stimuli, which is nice, but, you know, still a far cry from a proper theory of deep learning as we have for support vector machines, for instance. This is what we do in our team. We do deep learning for action detection. So given example videos, there are classes of deep networks called vision proposal networks that detect actions in videos and classify them. So you got a series of such detections in time. You link them up in time to form what people call action tubes. This is an example of that. And actually, we're quite proud we have what we believe is the only pipeline that can work online in real time. And also has some action prediction capabilities. So I said the final purpose is to be able to make predictions about the future. And this is something that can make predictions to a limited extent because you start observing a tube and you can predict what the future locations and the final label of the event you're looking at is going to be. So this is called a prediction capability, which is nice. But again, it's just not enough to do proper prediction. In order to do predictions, you need to know where the action you're observing is located in the bigger picture. So if you're cooking a meal, then you open the fridge, take ingredients off the fridge, you chop them on the counter, you put stuff on the stove, and so on, right? So you can make predictions if you place each of these individual events in the context of more complex activity. So if you learn to recognize complex activities, you observe a certain specific action, you can predict. So if you observe a person like opening the fridge, you can predict that in like 1-2 minutes time, they're gonna be chopping ingredients on the counter. So you can make predictions based on learning the structure of activities. You can use deep learning for that. This is an architecture that I proposed for a recent Google Research Award. In which you arrange individual actions and activity parts, and then you can make predictions. You observe a certain video after a certain point. There's your network that tells you this is the structure of the activity that best matches what you observed so far. Then you can predict, this is your best activity model. You can predict that the next action is going to be of a certain class, and it's going to take place in a certain part of the image plane, and also at a certain time. So you can predict when, where, and what class of action is gonna take place next, right? Again, sorry if I rush through this, but I think this is very conceptual, very high level, so I'm not really interested in trying to explain the details. But this is a line of reasoning. Is this still enough to make proper predictions for smart cars, for instance, right? No. But what I argue is that that's not the case, because humans do not just learn to recognize actions or activity patterns, but they learn to recognize that they're humans. They have the theorem, what in neuroscience called the theory of mind, ability of reading somebody else's mind, putting themselves in somebody else's shoes and making predictions using these little simulations they have of other people in their heads. We can do it. Maybe chimpanzee can do it. It's not clear yet. Can machines do it? So is that the point of this mini talk? So theory of mind, the idea is that you can think what other people think and guess what their future behavior is going to be based on your notion of how these people think and how they react to the environment. So again, I start from this problem because it's a very, very challenging one, and I can't stop, highlighting that. And I get a bit frustrated because when I talk to a lot of companies that they claim to be doing autonomous driving, most of the time they don't seem to grasp that there are such issues, and I don't understand why. You're a smart car driving down High Street in Oxford, and there are children walking on the sidewalk. What are they going to do? If you do motion prediction based on pattern, you will think they're going to keep walking on the sidewalk. If you're a human driver, you see an ice cream van on the other side of the street, and you see that one of the children is looking at the ice cream van. So there's a very high likelihood they will decide to cross the road and get to the ice cream, right? This is what people do when they drive. They use all their extensive knowledge about other people to make predictions. All right. So in particular, in neuroscience, there's a simulation theory of mind that based on this physiology of mirror neurons in the brain that states that basically we understand others because we have little simulations of these people or of other people running our heads. And whenever you observe an action, this is mirrored by this mirror neuron structure in our head, and they produce predictions about what I would do in the first place and what the people I know would do in a similar situation. There were previous attempts in artificial intelligence in the 80s and 90s called belief, design, intention. These are purely axiomatized formal logical reasoning approaches that lack any learning mechanism, though, so that there was no learning involved. So people were supposed to machines were supposed to have some rules encoded that allow them to make reasoning about how people's mental states and other agents' mental states evolve, but there's absolutely no learning link whatsoever to machine learning. So there's little, no connection so far between theory of mind efforts in AI and machine learning. The simulation theory of mind approach, in my view, seems to be more rooted in biological evidence, and also it's more adequate to a context in which learning is crucial and specialization driven by stimuli is crucial. What do I mean by that? I'll explain in a second. Another important concept in neuroscience is that those stereotypes. So we make predictions all the time based on stereotypes. So construction work. I see a person dressed as a construction worker, and they know they have a certain behavioral pattern. I see a child. I also know they have a certain behavioral pattern. So we make very, very fast inferences based on just judging the appearance of the people we deal with, right? And also, biological evidence suggests that neuron structures are reconfigured to describe agents that are recognized that belong to different classes. So you can make specialized predictions by running specialized simulations for different classes of agents. What is this useful for? And this is a little example. So there's a person showing up at the party venue. The party is upstairs, and their goal is to attend the party. Will they take the elevator or the stairs? And they're just sitting there, and they're standing there still, so there's no motion, right? Well, what sort of prediction could you make based on motion classification? Nothing, basically. But if you observe that they are children, they're probably very likely going to rush up the stairs. If there's an old guy waiting there, very likely he's going to take the elevator, and no offense to anybody involved. If there's a younger person carrying a bag, they might still want to use the elevator. So we when we make predictions in our heads, we use visual stimuli and stimuli at large to classify agents and make very, very quick inferences based on these classes. So I want to show in the next couple of slides that you can do that using deep learning. So to tackle these really difficult problems, you don't really need to go beyond deep learning in a technical sense. You need to, I mean, what I'm arguing is that you need to go beyond simple, very basic pattern recognition using deep learning, but you can use deep learning as a tool to create more sophisticated simulations and then allow you to produce more sophisticated predictions. So you can use reconfigure neural network. There have been a number of papers recently that support the idea of networks that can change their topology independence of the inputs they receive. For instance, if you're modeling the mental states of an agent, a rational person does not let emotions affect their intention. So if you judge a person to be rational, you will use a different simulation for their behavior. The way desires are mapped to intentions different between adults and children. So if your simulations for children is going to be different. So if I'm a child, I like ice cream. I see ice cream. I go for the ice cream. If I'm an adult, I like chocolate. I would like to go for chocolate, but I know it's not good for me. So I just avoid doing that. I postpone my happiness in the future in a way. So this is just an example of how you can reconfigure. You should be reconfiguring deep learning-based neural networks in order to describe simulations for different agents. So you want to describe the mental states of these agents and the interaction between. So the interaction between mental states can be described by a deep network, but the topology of the simulation should change in accordance to what you observe. So the context elements, the classes of the agents that you're observing, and so on. Can you do that using deep learning? Yeah. You can do that using the reinforcement learning. Again, I don't have time to talk about the details, but you can use reinforcement learning to learn the most appropriate topology for the network in order to encode the simulation that best predicts the behavior of the agent you're observing. So finally, this is the model. It's inspired by a neuroscientific model called hierarchical predictive encoding. It allows you to make, by describing in a flexible way, the topology of the interaction between mental states using deep learning allows you to make predictions about future actions, but also allows you to interpret the meaning or why certain actions are taking place. So if a person is raising an eyebrow, why are they doing that? You can also make inferences about mental states using these sort of models. So final message, and again, I apologize for the briefness of this, but there's going to be a Q&A session afterwards, so you have plenty of time to ask questions. Do we need to go beyond deep learning, which sounds funny in a session devoted to deep learning, but as I said, I don't really mean beyond deep learning as a technical tool. I think we need to go beyond pattern recognition because deep learning has been enjoying an enormous success, and that's not over yet, and we don't truly understand its mathematics. But we do understand, at least a few people are realizing that you need to go beyond simple pattern recognition towards new, true agent understanding, possibly neuroscience inspired. You need to incorporate semantics and logical reasoning, and so on. You need to incorporate stochastic analysis as exemplified by the AlphaGo success. This can be encoded by the sentence moving from machine learning to machine reasoning. So where reasoning is intended as something wider than just learning. So learning is an element of reasoning, but general AI, as people who worked at in the past, know that AI is about much more than just learning. So you need to have a more holistic approach. You need to teach morals, for instance, using reinforcement learning. You need to understand agents. All that can be done within the formalism of deep learning, but not applied in a naive way. All right. Thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Okay, thank you very much, and I'm handing over to Margarita for the last talk of the session.
Thank you very much for inviting me. Okay, so deep learning made really great progress in recent years. This progress was achieved mostly due to large amount of digital data available for training and for implementations that use GPUs and parallel processing. And it seems now that deep learning, machine learning, all these areas of AI become mature enough to be used in practical applications. And we can see that it's already been used in airports. These machines, which capture our biometric traits, are used to identify who we are. We use voice commands to operate our phones and other devices. Spam filters was used for quite a long time, but now they also use deep learning. Recommendation systems and all around it is heavily used. Malware detection now is moved to machine learning, deep learning cores. And self-driving cars, that's what we work on now. And it has all range of applications from just understanding what is around to high-level reasoning. Can deep learning be trusted? So this question was raised by Uzi before, and it turns out that there is some major problem in deep learning systems. It was shown two and a half years ago that you can take an image that convolutional neural network classifies as a panda, it's a panda, and you can edit some component which is specifically crafted noise, very small, and the result still looks like panda, and you can't see any difference between these two images, but the same neural network will say that it's gibbon or any other objects that you want with very, very high confidence. So there are different types, and this phenomenon is called adversarial noise and adversarial examples. There are different types, different algorithms that were proposed for this kind of effects. This one that I'm showing here is a very, very small noise added to the original image. And you can see that we can add it to trucks and to buildings and to dogs and to everything you want, and will always be classified as ostrich. A different type of adversarial noise, it's more sparse, but has higher magnitude. So you can see the dots, but it appear in very few places. And here you can see that each digit can be misclassified as each other digit. So on the diagonal, these are the correct classifications, and you see no noise. But in any other place, you can see that you can classify 0 as 1, 2, 3, or whatever you want. A somewhat different type of adversarial examples is the one that we see as a noise, or we can also talk about not visual, also a speech recognition. We hear it as a static, but it's actually an object. And a neural network will classify these funny-looking images as legitimate objects that was trained on. Same thing can be done with geometrical patterns. And you can see here this thing on the left is a king penguin, and see on the right is electric. I won't say that any of this would actually remind you of the object that it classifies. So there are quite a lot of work going on creating adversarial examples in terms of computer security and protecting against adversarial examples. There is a whole terminology going on now. So there are targeted, first of all, non-targeted adversarial examples. The idea is just to move the correct classification to a different thing. It's just not to classify correctly. And these are more simple algorithms that actually we know how to protect against them. But there are also another type of algorithm which are targeted, that I can specify the specific label that I want my image to be misclassified. As I showed you in the beginning. It was a panda. I wanted to be misclassified as a gibbon, so that's what I create the noise for that. And this type of algorithm, I can also specify the confidence level of the machine that it will predict. So these kinds of adversarial examples are very difficult to protect against. Also, most of these algorithms, they are image specific. So given an image, I can design some components that I will add to this image, and then the machine will classify it incorrectly. But there are also universal adversarial examples that target a collection of images. It could be of the same class or different classes, and they all will be misclassified, but exactly the same component. But again, all of them are, we don't see the noise. It's imperceptible to us, to humans. A problem with adversarial examples is that it's not something insignificant. It's a very large and serious phenomena. And these adversarial examples, they generalize well to different architectures. So I can craft my adversarial noise for one architecture, and it worked, and it will work and fool other architectures as well. Moreover, I can design these adversarial examples not only for deep learning, but for other classifiers as well. And the most horrifying thing is that I can do it for one classifier and apply it to a different classifier that allows to do black box attacks. So I can craft something at my office, and then I can attack the Google systems and Amazon systems and all the systems that we're using now. Another problem with adversarial examples is that they're abandoned. I will show you an example. So I took two directions in feature space, and I added the one direction on the top, the other direction on the bottom, and I added a different magnitude of the noise. So if I go to the right, I increase the noise in the image, and you can see it. On the left, you don't see any interference. On the right, you see some noise in it. So the original image is classified as snow leopard by CNN, but then when I, the one direction on the top, all of it is classified incorrectly as conch, and on the bottom, it starts as hare slide, and then I add more noise, it starts to classify it as hermit crab. So actually, it can create lots and lots of adversarial examples, and that is why it's very difficult to protect against them, because they just live in subspaces. Okay, so as machine learning scientists, this is very upsetting for us, and we're trying to solve this problem. We look into it for quite a while, but unfortunately, there is nothing. So we tried a few things. So first of all, RBF models are very nonlinear models, and they've shown to be empirically more robust to adversarial examples than others, but the problem with them is that they don't scale up to large problems with many categories, and these are not very usable in practice. Another thing that have been done is to train machines on adversarial examples. Just create new adversarial examples, add it to the training set, and then train the system on that. It showed some success. It becomes more robust and actually generalizes better, but to the new network that was trained on adversarial examples, I can create a new generation of adversarial examples that will attack it in 100%. So it with this iterative process, I continue and it will never end. There is some more success are for detecting adversarial examples. So instead of recognizing what is in the image, I just say if it's an adversarial example or clean image. This we can do now, but if I say that it's adversarial examples, that's just I have to throw it away. I cannot tell what is the object inside the image. Another thing that has been tried is a very simple thing called image preprocessing, just to remove this. I introduced it as a noise that I added, some components that I added to the image. Maybe I can filter it out. So we did try this tax, and I show you two kinds of images that we used to work on when we talk about adversarial example. One is very simple. It's a white objects on black background, usually digits or letters. And adding adversarial noise to this kind of images, we can remove just by simple thresholding. We just apply threshold, and it removes the adversarial effect from 95 to 97%, depending on the algorithm that we use to create adversarial noise. For natural images, they have more entropy in it, and just simple thresholding doesn't work. But if we can run filtering, simple filtering, like median filter or averaging, it also can remove adversarial noise from 35 to 60%, depending on the algorithms that we use. Well, you see, it's not a protection. 60%, it's the best we can do. It's still not very good for trusting the systems, but I will go back to it later on and we'll use it for something else. Okay, so I think I convinced you that adversarial examples is a real security threat, and there have been quite a lot of work in computer vision and different applications trying to create adversarial examples or be robust adversarial examples like object detection, object recognition, and things like that, segmentations. But here I listed a number of works that attacked physical systems with physical objects. So for the first work talks about they created real glasses. They printed some pattern on the glasses, just some dots. And when you put these glasses on, the deep learning systems that detect faces, they can't see you. They just see background. They don't see a face at all. Or it can impersonate to someone else. So I put these glasses and I will be you. So it's not an image, it's a real object, the glass. Speech recognition, it was shown that you can transmit some noise that to us is just a static noise, and it actually operates Siri or Google Talk, and it opens emails, sends email, gives your location, things like that, very nice things you can do to your phone, and you will never know. You can't hear it. It's not because it's low, it's because it's static. So if you're in a public place, you cannot just understand what's going on. Malware detection. So today, as I said, there are quite a lot of work going on with using deep learning for malware detection. And there's quite a lot of work showing that it could be easily fooled with adversarial attacks. Text classification for spam. And there are many others. I will not go through this. So let's summarize. Biometric identification have been attacked. Voice commands have been attacked. Spam filters have been attacked. Navigation, well, I wouldn't say that because there's some work going around. Malware detection, product recommendation, I haven't seen that, but I think it's, or I missed that, or it's going to be. Okay, so now I'm going to be a bit more optimistic, and we can actually use these adversarial examples to help in security, and I will talk about my work about capture, and there is also another work from UCL last NIPS on steganography. So capture, I don't know if you know what it is. These are completely automated public Turing tests that tells computer and humans apart. And they're actually used in online services, online application forms. When you need to fill the form, you just need to put this. It's usually some letters with some weird background that you can recognize and put. There are some other proposals. What happened a few years ago that Google showed that they could break any capture, and we thought that it probably is obsolete. So what we propose is to use, and we call it deep capture, we propose to use adversarial examples as capture challenges. Why? Because it's very easy for humans. We don't see this noise, or maybe we can see it, but it doesn't interfere with understanding of the image. And it's very difficult for any machine learning tool. And so we designed this new type of noise, which is immutable to a removing attacks. And showed you that a filtering can remove adversarial noise, so this kind of noise that we designed cannot be easily removed. And it is a little bit higher than the regular type of adversarial noise that you can see it, but still you can recognize the dog quite clearly. And there's an example of our system. You can see at the top the adversarial example, and the task is to recognize what the object in the image and to click on the correct answer. So this is this kind of bugs, and the correct answer is in the red box. Oh, we run some analysis, and we show that it's actually very secure, and it's a fun game for humans. My kids liked it a lot. So to summarize, machine learning and deep learning tools are widely used today, and we're here because of this. Adversarial examples is a serious problem, and it poses a security threat, and there is no generic reliable tools against adversarial examples in the moment. And last NIPS, this machine learning conference, there was two teams. One was trying to create adversarial example, the other was trying to protect against it. It was fun, but no major breakthroughs, fortunately. But as I said, we could use adversarial examples in constructive ways. I showed you deep capture, there are other works, and it also helps us to understand how machine learning works, how deep learning works, and actually to improve it. And maybe the way we should go is instead of saying this is an object or it's there, we should do more distributed outputs, and then it will be harder to fool. Thank you.
Okay, thank you very much for these three interesting talks. I would like to open up now for questions. Let's maybe start over there because otherwise I'll.
Thank you. Barbara Sahakian, I'm a neuroscientist at the University of Cambridge. I found it particularly interesting hearing about the more holistic approach to AI. And I'm particularly interested in what the human brain does really well compared to AI. And I think we are very good at creativity and multitasking. I think the computer that wins at Go was shown. And, of course, computers can beat people at Go, or another computer can beat people at chess. But we can play chess or Go or do lots of other things, so we're able to multitask. The point was also made about the difference between cold cognition and hot cognition, so the sort of rational problem-solving type of cognition and data crunching versus the more hot social cognition and emotional cognition. And that was theory of mind was brought up in that context. But of course, there's also other aspects of social cognition. And humans aren't always rational. We know that from behavioral economics that, you know, if we feel we're treated unfairly, we'll do something that is against the rational option. And also, we know that people are impulsive, people are compulsive, and many of us get obese, even though we know that we're not supposed to get obese. So I think that the human brain is quite difficult, but we are very good at probabilistic anticipation or prediction. The kind of example that was given was a child running out into a road, and we would put a likelihood figure on that happening, which I think is very important. So what I'm really asking about is how much of the hot cognition is being modeled, and in terms of the way that we learn, goal-directed versus habitual learning, or you know, the fact that we make cold decisions, but we also make hot decisions, and they're equally important in many cases where options are time-limited. How much of that is actually being modeled in some of the work that's going on? And I think also there was an example of a therapist brought up, AI therapist. And, you know, in therapy, it's actually more important to have empathy and to be likable, and people will get better. You just need minimal skills to do cognitive behavioral therapy appropriately. So I think these aspects are very important, I think, and I don't know how much they're being modeled.
Is this a question to somebody specific or to all three?
Yes, to Professor Haddad.
Brooke, thank you. I thought it's more for Fabio. It's more related to Fabio, I think.
Yeah, okay, that would be great. Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was more related to my reason. So I think my answer to that would be very little. So I think not a lot has been done in that direction. And by the way, I'm working on, you mentioned empathy, I'm working with a physician from the Nuffield Hospital in Oxford on a more empathic approach to healthcare, and this is part of that. And we're also working on the monitoring of awareness of people that suffer from strokes or heart attacks. And the idea there is to infer what mental states these people have, just judging from their behavior. So it's kind of the reverse implication that I showed in my diagram. So based on their observed behavioral pattern, what's going on in their heads. And I think not a lot has been done in this direction. And I quite liked your point, which I think is very, very relevant, that humans are not just optimized to solve a specific task, but as they live their lives, they go about optimizing multiple tasks. And all these tasks interact with each other. And that's what makes us more robust, right? So when we drive, we don't just switch on the autonomous driving subroutine in our head, but we use all of our knowledge. And this is what machines don't do, because as you rightly point out, they're designed each for a specific purpose, so they don't have that ability. So in order to move towards what I call machine reasoning, or like general AI, as people call it more often, you do need to start thinking about multi-purpose in machines that can do more than one thing, and learn from all these tasks. That's pretty much it. So I'm afraid the answer is quite negative. But on the other hand, this is a very nice thing, because that is a very exciting research direction. And again, I've been talking to neuroscientists and physicians about this, and they all sound very excited about it.
Okay, thank you. Do you want to take?
Yeah, I wanted to ask, I know Uzi is a computer scientist, but I want to ask you too, what is your academic background? Is it computer science, both? Yeah, so both of you are from computer science.
I'm a control engineer at BSc, and then I did my PhD on statistics, and now I'm a computer scientist, so I would say quite across the board, let's say.
No, because my theme is that artificial intelligence should not be left only for computer scientists, and this is basically relates to the question that you have to involve people from psychology, for sure, and maybe from other disciplines, in order to give, to get a good system working. This is why I asked.
I totally agree. This is the whole point of my intervention, really. I mean, it's, after all, neural networks, the concept of neural network itself was born out of biology, so we want to reproduce the inner workings of neurons. So why not keep being inspired by biology and neuroscience and psychology? I think that's the way to go, right?
Okay, there was a question in the back, and then maybe you can raise your hand in the meantime tonight.
Okay.
Does it work? Yes. Okay. I'm a deep learning practitioner at that start, so like all I've seen, a lot of things which are troublesome, and to a certain extent they are known to the community. So my question is the following, is mainly related to the first two talks. So we've been putting a lot of effort into designing systems which are end-to-end, which means they try to do multiple things at once, and it becomes very difficult to disentangle effects when they can come from any point on your model. And it was a point in the first talk when you say you change something, can be two or three labeled data points, can be two or three weights in a network, and its prediction changed completely. This has been the case, for example, for studies in reinforcement learning. So you change the random seed in a simulation, and the performance of the final agent changed dramatically, even if all the rest of the simulation is kept completely frozen. So shouldn't we switch to a more modular architecture? So trying to build components which give us guarantees, performance guarantees, stochastic guarantees, so they have a certain like prediction rate and other hard guarantees, and try to build end-to-end models composing modules, which is what we do with software. So we build components and then we try to like stack one on top of each other and we try to achieve certain like performance. But this has proved in the past to be less efficient than building end-to-end models. For example, in object recognition, going from like moduled architecture to end-to-end architecture has proved to increase performances. So should we sacrifice, in a certain sense, the shorter gain of performance to achieve a more modular architecture, which can be in the future more reliable in critical systems such as like autonomous driving or any other AI system which directly influences or can damage a people's life?
Yeah, I totally agree with you. The problem is that we are only at the beginning of this process of defining those components and make them robust, make them well-defined, define API. I think we are only in the beginning. I'm speaking about from the a practitioner perspective, speaking about from the experience of building a system, a real system in production. We are not there yet. We are not there. There's a lot of work to do, and I think this is not only work for the tech. It also work for the researcher in the university to think about it and to try to make it more modular and more robust. I agree.
If I can add something, this basically the 10 slides are removed from my presentation, and they were about this. So I totally agree with you, and the issue is a very fundamental one. So we should move towards robust machine learning. So not try and achieve the best performance on very limited training data, but design systems that are robust by design. So that can cope with, they produce like guarantees on the worst case scenario using minimax optimization, for instance. This was proposed, I think, by, I don't remember if it's Percy Liang or somebody else. Anyway, and there's a series of workshop in NIPS called Machine Learning in the Wild. I think one of the organizers is supposed to be here. So this is a problem that has been recognized. And I think statistics, you were mentioning statistics as an important role there. So I also work on random set theory, which is a generalization probability theory and more generally robust statistics. And I think there's a lot of scope for revising statistical learning theory in order to make the generalization bounds robust to variations in the distribution from which the test data is extracted. So that's really very, very fundamental work that is not just about deep learning, but it's about machine learning in general.
Yeah, so if I can add something, it's more or less the same thing we've been seeing like in reinforcement learning. So in reinforcement learning, we've seen AlphaGo success and other successes, and they're all based on model-free kind of agents. And it's because designing agents which have a model of the world has proved to be like difficult. But if we don't fall back in a certain sense to modeling the world around us, so tackling the multi-agent situation, it becomes difficult to generalize to different tasks.
Yes and no, because the strategies that they produce in AlphaGo, they are learned from examples initially. So it's a combination of, it's not just pure reinforcement learning, it's a combination of learning from examples and reinforcement learning. So you need to start from somewhere.
Yeah, you need to start from somewhere, but they do not include heuristics, for example. So it's, yeah, but I guess the point is that anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think it relates to the initial question. I mean, humans learn from in many different ways. They don't just learn from examples. They learn from trying and failing. They learn from, because they are taught from people that they trust and so on. So again, true artificial intelligence has to encode all these different channels for learning. And learning from examples is just one of them. It's probably not even the most important one. So.
Okay, thank you. I would actually like to take the last question before the coffee break. Maybe a quick question.
All right. I like this. Sorry. All right, so this is for Uzi, Haddad. So it's maybe a more or less rhetorical question. It's related to your slide about the dream team. I have a picture here, a lot about performance, monitoring, distributed system patterns, engineering, algorithms, coding. Can I ask you, do you think that the dream team will include maybe a data ethics, sorry, a data privacy lead, an ethics person, somebody who represents employees who will be displaced, that team, you know, the dream team that will consider the implications of an AI system after it's being deployed?
Yeah, this is a good question. This is a dream, you know, this is a dream team. This is not something really real. It was, if you saw the picture, it was the five top player in the NBA for, I think, ever. So it's happened very, very rarely that you have this kind of team. Yes, I think this is also should be included in this team, all those aspects, I agree. Yeah, meet the trainer.
I just want to add, and it should be included now, because then it will be too late.
Okay, I'm sorry I can't take all the questions because I believe people are interested in a coffee break, but I strongly encourage you to approach the speakers and continue the discussion in the coffee break. Thank you.